as the glittering skyline of Manhattan rises majestically above the Hudson River, casting its shimmering reflection upon the water below. It's easy to be captivated by the city's dazzling facade. But behind the gleaming skyscrapers and bustling streets lies a hidden history, steeped in mystery, intrigue, and tragedy. From the sordid tales of gangland violence and that once gripped the streets of the Five Points, to the haunting echoes of the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire, which claimed the lives of 146 garment workers in a blaze of unfathomable horror. New York City's past is rife with tales of darkness and despair. So join us as we journey through the labyrinthine alleyways of the city's past, explore the underbelly of the Big Apple, where notorious figures like Al Capone and John Gotti once held sway, and where the echoes of riots and unrest still resonate. Welcome to the gritty, gripping saga of New York City's dark history. Hi everybody, and welcome back to the Dark History Podcast, where we explore the darkest parts of human history. Hope everybody is well. I'm Rob, your host as always. Welcome to Season 3, Episode 9, New York City's Dark History. In today's episode, if it's not already obvious, we will peel back the layers of time to explore the dark underbelly of one of the world's most iconic cities, New York. Now, when you hear of the dark history of New York City, one story jumps right out at you, and of course that's 9/11. This is a dark chapter in New York City's history, but it's a path well trodden. So today, we'll look at some of the more obscure tales of the city that never sleeps. So without further ado, please turn off those lights, sit back, and relax next to the fire for more dark history. The General Slocum disaster was a tragic event etched into history on June 15, 1904. Despite its profound impact, the incident often remains overshadowed by the more widely known catastrophes, such as the aforementioned Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire or the Titanic disaster. One might speculate that the proximity of these latter events, both occurring within a relatively short time frame, diverts public attention from the harrowing tales of the Slocum's demise. The P.S. Slocum, a side-wheel passenger ship constructed in 1891, embarked on that fateful journey with 1,358 souls on board, including crew members. Chartered by the St. Mark's Evangelical Lutheran Church for the modest sum of $350, the majority of passengers hailed from the vibrant German-American communities nestled in the Lower East Side of New York City. Excitement and anticipation permeated the atmosphere as families eagerly awaited a delightful excursion away from the bustling city streets. As the vessel gracefully navigated the waters of the East River, laughter and chatter filled the air, creating an aura of joy and camaraderie amongst the passengers. However, tragedy lurked just beneath the surface of their merriment. In a cruel twist of fate, the day of leisure swiftly transformed into a nightmare of unimaginable proportions. The precise origins of the fire that engulfed the ship remain shrouded in mystery, with conflicting accounts muddling the narrative. Nevertheless, the reality of the inferno's ferocity became painfully evident within a mere half an hour of the Slocum's departure from the dock at approximately 9 a.m. Panic gripped the hearts of the passengers as flames ravaged the vessel, spreading with an alarming speed and ferocity. In the ensuing chaos, survival became a desperate struggle against the element. With most passengers being women and children, the prospect of perishing amidst the raging inferno or succumbing to the unforgiving embrace of the river's depths loomed ominously before them. The attire of the era, though fashionable, proved to be a hindrance, further complicating their chances of escape. For many, the ability to swim was a luxury they could ill afford, rendering them doubly vulnerable in the face of impending doom. Thus, as the General Slocum succumbed to the merciless forces of fire and water, it left in its wake a trail of devastation that reverberated through the German-American community of the Lower East Side. In the aftermath of the tragedy, the grim reality of the General Slocum disaster unfolded with devastating clarity. The relentless tide washed a macabre procession of lifeless bodies ashore in haunting repetition. Out of the 1,358 souls aboard the ill-fated vessel, a mere 321 emerged from the chaos. Their survival, a beacon of hope amidst the prevailing despair. For the fortunate few who defied the odds and emerged from the ordeal unscathed, theirs became a story of miraculous survival. Conversely, for those who witnessed the agonizing loss of loved ones, grief cast a long, unyielding shadow, leaving hearts shattered and spirits broken in its wake. In among the feelings of anguish and despair, questions swirled regarding the actions of Captain William Van Schaick, whose decision in the chaos would come under intense scrutiny in the days to follow. Reports surfaced alleging that Van Schaick, motivated by the concerns of insurance ramifications, opted against bringing the blazing vessel to shore, instead directing its course towards the desolate shores of North Brother Island. In his defence, Van Schaick cited the perilous presence of the gas tanks and lumberyards near the intended landing site at 130th Street, highlighting the inherent danger that would have compounded an already dire situation. Testimony that would follow in the days ahead established that there were few safeguards. Life vests were rotten, lifeboats were in the same state, fire drills were non-existent, and the crew were untrained to handle the panic that followed on board the Slocum. Eyewitnesses from the shore could see the boat burning and wondered why the captain did not come to shore. Quickly, Van Schaick and the Knickerbocker Steamboat Company came under the crosshairs of the investigation. Frank A. Burnaby, the president of the company, defended the actions of the captain and the crew. On January 27, 1906, justice was meted out to Captain Van Schaick by the jury of the United States Circuit Court. He was found guilty of criminal negligence that he had failed to maintain fire drills required by law. Judge Thomas, the presiding judge, sentenced Van Schaick to 10 years of hard labour. And what do you think happened to the company that owned the ship and its director? Of course, the Knickerbocker Steamboat Company and Frank Burnaby escaped justice and got away scot-free. Even Van Schaick would serve only part of his sentence at Sing Sing Prison. He received a pardon through the efforts of his wife from President William Howard Taft in 1911.
My name is Koji.
And I'm Michelle.
And this is the Japanese America Podcast. So this is where we look at all things Japanese American. We will bring alive the history, culture, and people that make up this diverse community.
In this month's episode, we'll examine Koji's unique family history.
To help bring the story alive, we brought on actor and comedian Derek Mio.
He was reported to be extremely pro-Japanese and anti-American in sentiment. Her husband was taken into custody by the military authorities under a warrant authorized by the Secretary of War.
Who was his enemy of the United States? He was my grandfather on my dad's side. To hear more stories about Japanese America, you can listen to this podcast anywhere you normally download your podcast.
Moving on from the General Slocum disaster to another of New York's tragic events, as we travel back to the Civil War era America. The New York City draft riots unfolded in July of 1863 amidst the fervent backdrop of the Civil War. The eruption of violence stemmed from a deep-seated resentment harboured by working-class New Yorkers towards the newly enacted federal draft law, igniting a conflagration of rage that engulfed the city for 5 days. This period witnessed some of the bloodiest and most destructive riots ever witnessed on American soil, leaving a trail of devastation in its wake. As the economic hub of the nation, New York City faced the onset of civil war with trepidation, fearing the loss of the South as a crucial trading partner. Cotton held immense value for the city's merchants, comprising of 40% of all goods shipped from the bustling port before the conflict. Despite the abolition of the slave trade in 1808, an underground market for enslaved individuals persisted in the city. The ties between New York's business interests and the Confederate States were so strong that secession from the Union was considered when war erupted in 1861. Throughout the conflict, New York's anti-war politicians and newspapers cautioned its predominantly white working-class citizens, many of whom were Irish or German immigrants, about the potential of ramifications of emancipation. They feared being displaced in labor forces by newly freed individuals from the South. President Abraham Lincoln's announcement of the Emancipation Proclamation in September of 1862, set to take effect in the following year, confirmed these fears for many workers. The decision sparked protests among the city workers, and even within New York Regiment, whose members had enlisted to prevent the Union rather than abolish slavery. In early 1863, faced with pressing need for manpower, the government, under President Lincoln, implemented the stringent conscription law. This law mandated that all male citizens aged between 20 and 35, as well as unmarried men between 35 and 45, were liable for military duty. Despite the implementation of a lottery system to select eligible men, individuals could evade service by either hiring a substitute or paying a hefty fee of $300 to the government, a sum equivalent to the annual earnings of the average American worker at the time, rendering draft avoidance a luxury afforded only to the wealthiest. Complicating matters further, the exemption of black men from the draft due to their non-citizen status exacerbated simmering tensions. This discriminatory policy underscored the systemic inequities inherent in the draft process. While protests erupted in other cities such as Detroit and in Boston over the draft, none matched the intensity of the turmoil witnessed in New York City. In the lead-up to the city's inaugural draft lottery, on July 11, 1863, anti-war newspapers stoked the flames of dissent, lambasting the new conscription laws and exacerbating the growing frustrations among the white working-class citizens. This volatile atmosphere would set the stage for a cataclysmic event that would unfold during the New York draft. For the first 24 hours after the lottery, the city remained suspiciously quiet, but rioting began early on the morning of Monday, July the 13th. Thousands of white workers, mainly Irish and Irish Americans, started by attacking military and government buildings and became violent towards people who tried to stop them, including the insufficient numbers of policemen and soldiers the city's leaders initially mustered to oppose them. By the afternoon, however, they had moved to targeting black citizens' homes and businesses. In one notorious example, a mob of several thousand people, some armed with clubs and bats, stormed the Colored Orphan Asylum on Fifth Avenue near 42nd Street, a four-story building housing more than 200 children. They took bedding, food, clothing, and other goods and set fire to the orphanage, but stopped short of assaulting the children, who were forced to go to one of the city's almshouses. In addition to black people themselves, rioters turned their rage against white abolitionists and women who were married to black men. The city's white dock workers, long opposed to the black men working on the docks alongside them, took the opportunity to destroy many of the businesses near the docks that catered for black workers and attack their owners, as a part of their efforts to erase the black working class from the city. By far, the worst violence was reserved for black men, a number of whom were lynched or beaten to death with shocking brutality. In all, the published death toll of the New York City draft riots was 119 people, though estimates of the actual number of people killed reached as high as 1,200. New York leaders struggled with the task of containing the draft riots. Governor Horatio Seymour was a peace Democrat who had openly opposed the draft law and appeared sympathetic to the rioters. New York City's Republican Mayor George Opdyke wired the War Department to send federal troops, but hesitated on declaring martial law in response to the rioting. On July the 15th, the third day of the protests, riots spread to Brooklyn and Staten Island. The following day, the first of more than 4,000 federal troops arrived from New York's regiment who had been fighting in the Battle of Gettysburg. After clashing with the rioters in what is now the Murray Hill neighborhood, the troops were finally able to restore order, and by midnight of July the 16th, the New York City draft riots had come to an end. In addition to the death toll, the riots had caused millions of dollars in property damage and made some 3,000 of the city's black residents homeless. What would a Dark Histories episode be without a good murder story? And this one is baffling. On March the 9th, 1929, New York City was shaken by the perplexing crime that had confounded law enforcement and intrigued crime enthusiasts for generations. At the centre of the enigmatic tragedy was Isidore Fink, a 30-year-old man known for his reserved demeanour and ownership of a modest laundrette business located on 4 East and 132nd Street. Situated in a gritty neighbourhood plagued by frequent robberies, Fink was notoriously cautious, often securing his windows and doors with the utmost diligence, particularly during the late night working hours. Only customers whom he personally recognised were guaranteed entry into this establishment at night. The event of that fateful night unfolded when Fink's neighbour, Mrs. Lachlan Smith, resided at the rear of the tenement building, was startled by the sound of a disturbance emitting from Fink's laundrette. Alarmed, she hastily sought assistance, which arrived in the form of patrolman Albert Kattenborn. Upon reaching Fink's door and receiving no response from his knock, Kattenborn encountered a locked entrance. However, his keen observations revealed a slender transom window slightly ajar above the door. Realising the window was too narrow for his own entry, Kattenborn enlisted the help of a nimble young lad who managed to squeeze through the transom. With the door unlocked, from within, Kattenborn proceeded to investigate the mysterious scene unfolding inside. At the rear of the laundrette, patrolman Kattenborn made a grim discovery. Isidore Fink lay lifeless, the victim of a brutal attack. His body bore evidence of two gunshot wounds to the chest and one to the left hand. The scene suggested that Fink had been working, as evidenced by the hot iron resting on the illuminated gas stove at the time of the assault. Despite thorough searches for a weapon, neither Kattenborn nor the subsequent arrival of homicide detectives yielded any findings. The absence of a discernible murder weapon perplexed the investigators, leading them to entertain the possibility of a staged suicide. However, their search for any contraption that could have propelled the gun aside proved futile. Frustration mounted as they meticulously combed through every inch of the room, tearing apart the floorboards and scrutinising the walls, yet no clue surfaced. With suicide ruled out, the detectives came to the chilling realisation that they were confronted with a real-life manifestation of the classic locked-roomed mystery. This narrative trope, a mainstay of detective fiction, revolves around the murder victim discovered within a sealed room, devoid of any apparent means of entry or escape for the assailant. The enduring allure of this genre lies with the writer's intrigue in crafting a solution that defies expectations. A tradition exemplified by Edgar Allan Poe's seminal work, The Murder in the Rue Morgue, often heralded as the first modern detective story. In the investigation surrounding Isidore Fink's murder, the New York Police Department initially positioned a theory that the assailant fled through the open transom window, supported by the discovery of a broken hinge. However, this scenario raised perplexing questions. For one, it implied that the perpetrator was diminutive, no larger than a young boy. Moreover, it seemed implausible that someone would opt for such a cumbersome escape route when simply unbolting the door would offer a swifter exit. An alternative hypothesis proposed that the killer, thwarted by the locked apartment door, resorted to firing a shot through the open transom window from outside. Yet this explanation faltered upon close scrutiny. Examination of Frink's hand revealed the telltale scorch marks consisting of a close-range gunshot, suggesting a struggle ensued over the weapon. The medical examiner concluded that Frink sustained the hand injury during the altercation, prior to being fatally shot twice in the chest as he attempted to retreat. And then there was the problem of the motive. Clearly, it had not been a robbery, as investigations found money in Frink's pocket and the laundrette's cash register. So who could have wanted to violently murder an inoffensive laundryman who minded his own business? There were reports that two well-dressed women had been seen in the hallway outside the laundrette just before the shooting, but when the officers visited Frink's home address at 52 East 133rd Street, his landlord, Mark Schwartz, described his tenant Fink as someone who had never consorted with women and had no known enemies. 2 years later, on August 3rd, 1931, NYPD Commissioner Edward P. Mulrooney admitted his bafflement on a WOR radio show called Man in the Front Row. During the course of his talk, Mulrooney discussed three crimes. One of those was Fink's murder, which he declared to be an insoluble mystery. But was he right? Early on, investigators had worked on the assumption that Fink was shot in the hallway and that took refuge in the laundrette, bolting the door against his assailant. This had been quashed by the medical examiner, who said that the chest wounds Fink sustained would have killed him almost instantaneously, giving him no time to carry out the task necessary. So is the murder unsolvable? Thank you for taking the time out of your day to listen to this dark episode. So yeah, that was some of the many tales of the dark history of New York. Just adding to today's stories, prior to the Solcombe disaster, the German-American community was a vibrant and active neighbourhood of the working class and highly educated. The shock of losing so many loved ones, suicides and depression resulted from such a loss, caused many residents to move away. Other communities were impacted as well. There was loss of life among the people on board from the Jewish and the Italian communities also. Standing in Tompkins Square Park is a Tennessee marble obelisk dedicated to the victims of the General Slocum disaster. The fountain was erected in 1906 by the Sympathy Society of German Ladies. Etched into the marble are these words: "They are Earth's purest children, young and fair." Moving on to the riots, the New York draft riots remain the deadliest riots in US history, even worse than the 1992 Los Angeles riots and the 1967 Detroit riots. Going back to the Colored Orphanage Asylum, they attempted to rebuild on the same site after the riots. Neighbouring property owners protested, and the orphanage would eventually be relocated to a sparsely settled area north of the city that would later become Harlem. Stunned by the riot, the abolitionist movement in New York revived itself slowly, and in March of 1864, less than a year after the draft riots, New York City saw its first all-black volunteer regiment in the Union Army march with the pomp and circumstance through the streets before boarding their ship on the Hudson River. But despite the meaningful victory, the draft riots would have devastating impact on the city's black communities. While the 1860 census recorded 12,414 black New Yorkers, by 1865, the city's black population had declined to 9,945 by 1865. the lowest number since 1820. Also going back to the Izzy Adar Frink murder, something strange emerged decades later in a story from across the Atlantic that demonstrated just how extraordinarily resilient the human body can be when struck down with terrible injuries. A Scottish businessman left his Edinburgh hotel one winter's evening. When he didn't return later that night, the hotel staff were unconcerned, for the businessman was notoriously erratic in his habits. Sure enough, at 7:30 a.m. the following morning, he rang the doorbell. When the maid opened it, the man was dressed normally and carrying an umbrella. She noticed that his face was bloodstained. He brushed aside her concern, telling her not to worry, and that he would go upstairs and have a wash. He then placed his umbrella on the rack, hung up his coat, and went upstairs to the bathroom. He then collapsed and died 3 hours later. What was startling about this man was he had attempted suicide by shooting himself in the head, and in doing so, taking a huge chunk of his brain out. The police tracked a trail of blood from the hotel to a park across the road. In the park lay a revolver that belonged to the man and a massive pool of blood, brain matter and bone fragments, also belonging to the man. At some point, he had got up and walked around the gardens, forming a 165-yard circle of blood spot in the snow, before returning to the shelter, where he rested again. Then he made a final journey back to the hotel. Letters found in the man's effects made it clear that he was planning suicide. And what has this got to do with Fink? Were the police initially right? Could Fink have been shot in the hallway, survived the unsurvivable injuries for just enough time to bolt the door, only to die minutes later? Only the murderer, and Izzy Adar Fink, could answer that. There are more than enough stories to make a part two, if it's wanted. One teaser is the story of the first death attributable to an automobile in the United States. It took place in New York City on September 13, 1899, when on Central Park West and West 74th Street, a man named Henry Hale Bliss, a 69-year-old real estate broker, was returning home at 235 West and 75th Street. After descending from a trolley, he was reportedly assisting a female companion to do the same when a passing taxi knocked him to the ground and ran him over, crushing his skull and chest. Bliss succumbed to his injuries the following morning. Anyway, if you could please drop us a review on the show, it really does help the podcast out. The more reviews, the more algorithm pushes the show out there. If you think friends and family may be interested in the podcast, then share it with them. Links to all socials are below. I know adverts can be a pain sometimes, but if you would like ad-free episodes, the link to the show's Patreon is also below. The Patreon is for people who want to support the channel, but don't feel like you have to. As always, if you've been listening for a while and not subscribed, please do that. In that way, you never miss an episode. So with all that out the way, thank you again for listening. Join us next time for our next episode as we delve into another event and more dark history.